The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come to order. The vice chair is excused for the day. We're going to have an informational meeting first from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Just a quick update on the active shooter program that's been in place for a decade. Then we're going to move down to Senate Bill 127, go back up to the other informational meetings, and then move down through the schedule as is right there. Senator Olson, you have anything? Senator Courtney, you fine? If not, gentlemen, you're on.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Todd Anderson. I'm the training director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I've been in public safety for 30 years and the retired sheriff of Tillamook County. As the training director of DPSST, I've had the pleasure to work with a highly qualified group of staff members at DPSST who do both basic training for police classes and regional training. Today we're going to talk specifically about the active shooter and some of the veterans awareness training, and I've asked Lieutenant Mike Herbis, who's seated to my right, to give you an update on those programs, sir.
Thank you.
Chairman Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Lieutenant Herbis. I've been employed in law enforcement since 1988, and I've been employed by DPSST as regional training coordinator for the last 11 years. I'm here to talk about the active shooter and veterans awareness training that we do regionally around the state. In the DPSST folder in front of you, you have the active shooter information on the left, which I'll be covering first, and the veterans awareness training on the right that I'll be covering second. The active shooter training program is conducted with multiple agencies throughout the state and often involves both schools as well as places of business, oftentimes working with their individual security personnel or as a training site host or on procedural development for their own procedures. The first piece of paper is a list of agencies that have either hosted or participated in this training in the last year to 2 years attached. Just for your information, it is not all-inclusive. There are many agencies around the state that conduct their own training without requesting assistance from the regional training program, so this list is by no means all-inclusive. That is followed by a handout that we give to both law enforcement as well as to the places of business or the schools. It was a recent handout sent around the nation by the Department of Homeland Security and addresses ways of preparing and reacting to an incident at a place of business. We also at times, upon request, make presentations to local school districts. For example, the Blue Mountain Educational Service District, which encompasses most of the schools in a three-county area in eastern Oregon. And when we go to many of the local communities, law enforcement invites their school administrators, superintendents, and/or principals to attend the training as well, to facilitate the sharing of plans and techniques. Training is conducted with the Oregon State Police as partners in both the development and the instruction to stay current on best practices and aid in uniformity of techniques, tactics, and procedures throughout the state. The emphasis is on multiple interagency cooperation, especially in the more rural areas of the state where the response may initially consist of just one officer from each of varying agencies. The second handout in the covers a research that was recently sent to us that we include. It's research on various medications used by some of the shooters. I include it in its entirety for increased situational awareness of the students. It covers incidents as well as shooting events in the United States. This was compiled by Professor Healy, and attached to the back page of that is his email written permission for us to include this research as part of the training. Due to the recent high-profile incidents around the nation, the operations tempo of training and the number of training requests around the state has greatly increased. With the high priority of conducting active shooter training, this has impacted the regional training program's ability to conduct other training such as vehicle stops, building searches, etc. We recently finished a second instructor development course for the Oregon State Police and have one scheduled in Deschutes County in April. Hopefully this addition of instructors around the state will alleviate some of the scheduling bind that various agencies have. This concludes my briefing on the active shooter training that we're conducting. What are your questions?
We'll go on the other one if you want. We're going to do veterans too.
Then
we'll
go back to veterans.
Yes, sir. On the veterans training, we have the first page is a list of agencies or entities, hospitals, fire departments, et cetera, that have attended the various veterans training that we provide regionally around the state. The training is two parts in a four-hour session. The first two parts is conducted by the Federal Veterans Administration, and the second two parts is conducted by myself on behalf of the DPSST. The VA portion primarily covers post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, veterans justice outreach programs, and veterans courts. Many of the ways to recognize and assist in veterans getting help upon contact with law enforcement, trying to get the prevention before they get involved in the legal system. The DPSST portion is twofold. On one side, we emphasize that the vast majority of veterans reintegrate without any incident or any issues back into their communities and into their society, into our society. But we also necessarily have to put emphasis on training that officers need to be able to recognize they're dealing with a veteran, whether it be stickers on the vehicle, something they're wearing, their mannerisms, how they talk, and aware that a veteran can be a highly trained and dangerous person if a situation goes bad. Another thing that we try to put a lot of emphasis on is the benefits of veterans in the community, both to law enforcement as well as the community. One example of this that I use and I share with law enforcement agencies is an agency back east has several members of the National Guard's 20th Special Forces Group that are police officers, and they have integrated some of the counterinsurgency techniques that they use successfully in Afghanistan to help their police department develop community policing systems that would work better dealing with their inner city gang problem, and they have been doing this to great success. We include veteran scenarios in most all of the regional training we do around the state, whether it is building search, vehicle stops, or any of the other training we do. We always try to include at least one or two veteran scenarios to increase the awareness and the techniques for dealing with for the officers. It increases their knowledge and helps them to develop effective ways of recognizing and interacting with veterans. The handout behind that is the PowerPoint presentation that we present as DPSST. I do not have the federal VA's presentation. That is from Linda Matty at Portland VA Hospital. And attached to the back of that is a list that we present to all law enforcement agencies. It comes from some of my friends still in the U.S. military, a list of all the different entities around the nation where they can provide get help for veterans. This concludes my briefing on veterans awareness for regional training. What are your questions, sir?
Just for the record, you're in the military, right?
Yes, sir.
You want to tell the rest of the committee so that they know?
Chairman Boquist and members of the committee, I have 27 years of active reserve time, the last over 20 of it in the Army Special Forces. I'm a Sergeant Major and Alpha 119 in the 19th Special Forces Group with multiple overseas theater deployments.
So the point is, committee members, this has got a lot of experience here. And yeah, it's a big benefit to the state of Oregon to have that experience brought back to the Department of for training purposes. Questions, Senator Olson?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much for your service to start with. Secondly, in your active shooter report, it's very, very good, information. But how would you, what would you tell a person that has a CHL if they get involved in an active shooter situation and they decide to respond? How would you tell them what to do after the incident is terminated and the police are just now coming in? How does that person supposed to react? I mean, what is he supposed to do so he doesn't get shot?
Chairman Boquist and Senator Olson, in response to your question, when presented that, which comes up quite frequently, what I tell most citizens with a CHL, if they are involved in a shooting afterwards, to reconceal the handgun or the weapon that they have so that it is not visible and move away from the immediate proximity of the threat. over the suspect that they have shot, and immediately keep their hands free and exposed and identify themselves to incoming police officers, complying with all commands and doing what they're told, that law enforcement will sort it out after they have the scene secured.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any questions?
I just, Chair Boquist, I just have one follow-up piece. We also have integrated and updated the 16-week basic police curriculum, which contains a veterans awareness and a mental health piece. And I think this is, it's very important for both of those issues. And so we're spending more time on the mental health and the veterans issues. And most recently, we're meeting with Lions for Life, which I believe you're aware of, that answered some 8,000 calls from veterans on their suicide hotline. And they have experts who are trained in de-escalation. And now we're working on integrating those programs, the mental health and veterans awareness and de-escalation, into the basic police class.
Well, we appreciate that. I guess I do. I have one question, and this is just a scientific swag. Sir Major will know what this is. We've been at this since 2002. 2005, Senator Verger and I had this before our committee back there in emergency preparedness. And the training mechanism for these sorts of things, and even veterans training other than recently, is in the regional training programs. And, you know, really in 10 years we've come a long way, but we still don't have the entire public safety force trained. Any estimate on your idea in a ideal world of how many more years before we, of course, we never will get everybody trained because there's a cycle of going around. But how do we improve the outreach, I guess, is the question here, over the next couple of years to get more people trained?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, as we've said, you know, there are a number of issues. Right now, the demand is for the active shooter training throughout the state. And I think, as everybody is aware, the state's resources have been reduced over the last several years. And so folks that don't receive the veterans awareness training and basic training have to have it in the regional piece. Right now, we have two regional folks that serve the entire criminal justice system for the state of Oregon. Now, if you're in the Portland metro area or Salem, you may have your in-house training units which can provide this training. But if you're out of those metro areas in the valley, it's incumbent upon us to provide that training. So as with everything else, we understand that resources are limited, but assistance in the regional piece would be of great assistance and allow us to train more public safety officers in the state of Oregon.
One quick follow-up, because if I look at both programs, because they're both run by your department, but both of them have mental health components in them, it looks like.
That is correct. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, that is correct. We have enhanced our mental health awareness in both the veterans piece, the active shooter piece, and as well as the basic police and the basic corrections courses that are held at DPSST.
Great. Appreciate it. There's no further questions. We appreciate the presentation.
Thank you for your time.
With that, colleagues, we're going, due to some time constraints, we're going to move down the agenda to a public hearing on SB 127. I'm going to open that public hearing right now. And Paul Romain and Mike Condon, who has got an appointment elsewhere, will be coming up. Council, if you'll bring us up to speed on 127.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senate Bill 127 was previously heard on March 21st. This is the measure that permits customers to operate appropriately equipped gas pumps when they're ordered to evacuate in an emergency. There's been discussion and some amendments prepared to replace that content with a requirement for installation of generator drops when facilities that dispense fuel are constructed or renovated. We received some very helpful input from the State Fire Marshal's Office, and I believe these gentlemen are here to talk about additional fuel and emergency-related issues, not necessarily the specific contents.
And colleagues, I just remember, if you remember in the Oregon Resilience Plan that we had done, one of the key factors is how do you get gas out of the ground when you have no electricity? And where are we at in that process? And again, committee members, remember, for those of the public, we're talking, the resilience plan calls for a 50-year plan, not next week, as I was interviewed outside, a 50-year plan. And with that, gentlemen, I'll let one of you lead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. And Mike, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Condon. My day job is I'm the West Coast Crisis Manager for BP's operations, and I'm here representing the Western States Petroleum Association.
We're here more in a informational position. Actually, we like the idea of self-service, but I'm not sure you really want to go there.
No, Paul, we don't.
But having moved off of that, we'll talk about emergency preparedness. It's a matter of cost. It's a matter of how much you want to put into the system. And really what we think you should be doing is focusing on the places where there will be the most need. Because if there is a disaster, which is really what you have to plan for, not just an emergency, a disaster. We're fortunate here. You get a windstorm, we're out of power for a few days. You get some trees down, we can't deliver gasoline to the coast, stuff like that. You get a catastrophic earthquake, then you have a disaster. And at that point, you really don't want the population driving. What you want to do is make sure your emergency vehicles have the equipment, the power, the gasoline, everything else. And that's really where this should focus, not having every station out there be prepared to put in some equipment. You should treat it like a military operation. As some on the committee may know, you try and make sure everything's pretty much the same. It all works together. You don't go into a battle with everybody getting to choose their own weapon and bringing bullets for each one of their weapons. You generally standardize most everything. Same thing here. The cost of putting in, of renovating each gas station is very, very difficult, very high. So what we would suggest is if you're going to look at something, you look at something that's centralized and that key places that have fuel for emergency service vehicles, perhaps that's the focus of it, nothing else. With that, I'll let Mike kind of give you more his take on it, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, I'll kind of go on to what Paul said, but maybe step back a little more general. As the chair pointed out, the issue is a little more than just getting gas out of the ground. It's a big disaster like that. It's getting, once it's out of the ground, even if you get it there, your gas stations have a limited supply. The issue is going to be infrastructure. And can you get gasoline back to those places? And I said, if an earthquake, you don't know where that's going to be. You don't know what bridges, what roads are going to be like, the conditions of the tanks. One thing to keep in mind, we've had similar proposals in other states, and you're not powering just the pump, the submersible pump, to pump out the gasoline. You've got the monitoring systems which have to run, and the safety aspect, you've got to test and make sure those tanks are intact and the lines before you start activating them again. The power is substantial. It isn't, like I say, so you're just not turning a little turbine pump. You've got monitoring systems, safety, lighting. There'd be security issues, even if you're trying to supply a spot for just emergency vehicles. So as was pointed out, maybe approach would be look at where you have existing refueling for emergency vehicles, whether that's police, fire, and maybe those are the places you might want to consider having the capability to keep those online, a finite number of spots where you could look at potential supply routes. And one of the big issues will be the terminals. They're along the waterfront. We drill quite frequently through using the incident command system with local, state, and federal emergency responders. We're used to working with them. So prioritizing would not be an issue. The issue would be getting those terminals, are they intact? Are those big tanks intact? Can trucks get in there? So those are just some of the considerations that seem to go beyond having power drops at individual service stations scattered everywhere.
Mr. Chair, if I might make one other comment. A lot of times people look to Florida with their emergency preparedness. Florida's used to getting, they have emergencies every year. A hurricane comes in. I mean, they know they're going to get slammed. The question is it one or five or six or whatever it is? They also they know the evacuation routes. They know where people are going to go. And it's generally once that hurricane comes on shore, once it gets to the interior, it's not causing as much damage. It's a little easier to set up something there than it is to plan in a state like Oregon where frankly, the last time we had anything, we had a significant windstorm, I believe, in 2007, but that cut off the roads. We had the fuel, we just couldn't get the fuel down to the coast. I believe the same thing happened up in Washington State, in eastern Washington. We had 1962 with the Columbus Day storm. Things are a little different now. But it's really a cost-benefit situation. How much do you want to spend versus what the real risk is versus, you know, what you're going to get out of it? And, you know, we'll do whatever you want us to do. Just understand that from our standpoint at the retail level and the wholesale level, there is no money in retail gasoline. The reason we know that is the majors have gotten out of retail gasoline. If there was money in it, they would be in. So it's not something we can just go ahead and say, oh, great. Now, if you want to talk about trading self-service for some of these things, we'd be happy to talk about it.
Not this session, we won't. I do have a question. Florida model, if I recall correctly, what they did is because we have all the models, there's about a dozen states with different models. In Florida, they identified the evacuation routes, so on and so forth, and then they worked backwards, and I think they used incentives, not only tax credits and so on and so forth, you know, again, like us. We're hoping it doesn't come for 50 years, so we have 50 years to do this. So you won't be a lobbyist for them in 50 years, Paul, so that'll work out good. But
I know, I may.
So and is that the sort of thing? Can you give a little description of are we right in the characterization of Florida and how they did it, or?
Chad, I'll try that one. The thing with Florida, as Paul pointed out, is that those geared mainly for hurricanes, which one you see coming. They can plan for them. I know our company's response is we identified those routes that were along the major evacuations. We set up at the power drops. The generators were purchased and are stored off-site because you don't know, even though they're evacuation routes, you don't know which ones are still going to be standing.
Right.
And then afterwards, they can bring the generators in. They've also sized those that the incremental cost is such that it's not that much more to run the whole station if you're going to go to the initial, you know, you're talking $100,000 investment per station to do that. And that can then supply the ice and power and refrigeration stuff that maybe the community needs. And those are really geared as much towards public as they are emergency response. The big difference there is it's aimed at a type of event which is predictable and repeatable and occurs, you know, frequently to some point where some of the individuals down there will take those generators and they can lease them out in the off season to recoup some of that cost back. And recall them during hurricane season. So it's a much different situation, though, to keep in mind in Florida, than the main thing out here would be planning for an earthquake, which you don't know when it's going to hit, and you don't know, you know, the subsequent infrastructure damage.
Question, Senator Olson?
Yes, I do. Mr. Kynan,
yes.
You had just mentioned $100,000 per station in Florida. What does that cost entail?
From Senator and Chair, from our look at this for a similar bill in Washington about 5 years ago after the 2007, our folks, our people down in Florida, that was for putting in the pads, the switch gear, the permitting. The initial investment was roughly $60,000-$65,000 without the generator to get the sites ready, and then about $45,000 for, you're talking about an 80 to 100 kV generator
okay.
to run a site.
Follow up?
What?
You know, as you had mentioned, their storms are predictable out here. We have no idea what's going to happen. So what would be BP's response to a earthquake in Portland? Because the reason I ask this question is that, you know, it's good to think that we can get the fire stations and the police stations up, but, you know, after about a week, you're going to have citizens irate because they need to get places, get food, run their generators, run their chainsaws to help them recover. So what would be BP's response to that? How would you be able to supply product?
Or what would be a typical? We're not going to pick on BP.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Appreciate
it. Yeah, typical.
I'm
sorry. I apologize. But since you're in the hot seat.
Well, first of all, assuming that our terminal was up and operating and we might have to work with local emergency responders to help secure power for that, then the whole system, issue of allocation is very sensitive, but first priority is getting fuel to emergency responders. And then it would be working through the unified command system and with local, state, and federal officials to identify which sites are functioning, which sites are safe to deliver to, and it would be planned at that time. There isn't an existing plan that says when this happens, we'll go to these three sites first. It would have to, we have a plan right now. Our response is, there's a, for instance, an earthquake, is to gather the information to establish a report and just do an assessment of what the condition of our sites are, so that we can. And again, our branded sites. There's a variety of channels of trade, as they're called, but we don't operate. The major oil companies don't operate the stations. They're operated by independent, you know, or franchisees.
Right.
And so there's those contractual issues there as well that would have. It's not a simple answer, but we have a allocation procedure and that we would go through to first assess where we can deliver and then have to come up with a plan on who gets what, because there'd be sensitive issues with Paul's folks about, you know, are we giving preference to certain distributors, which we would not be the case.
Follow up. If this event happened and our terminals in Portland were gone, do you have a source other than Seattle to bring in fuel from, say, the east or the south?
Senator Olson, Chair, the Olympic, I was the emergency response coordinator for Olympic Pipeline for 5 years, and 95% of all the motor fuels in western Washington and Oregon come down the Olympic Pipeline. That is the supply route. Some of them come from barge. There is no existing east-west infrastructure to bring fuel over. In a FEMA conference in Bothell last year, infrastructure review, the FEMA approach was that in a large event like that, that the locals would probably not be counted on to supply anything in the way of people or equipment or materials, because people are going to be taking care of their own, and that it would all come from east through a federal response, military, you know, type response, bringing fuel over, caravan in. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question.
No, it's interesting that that we would be in dire straits. And
yes.
I was just wondering if you had fuel sources in California that could be counted on to bring fuel north, or fuel sources in Idaho or Utah to bring fuel from the east.
Depending on the size, there are the refineries, of course, the four refineries up in Whatcom County in Washington, and then the California refineries, and they can barge fuel up. So it takes several days, and then it would depend on the infrastructure conditions of the offloading facilities in the rivers at the terminals now to get it in here.
Final follow-up. If we had the big one, the big earthquake,
yeah,
and the entire West Coast was debilitated, what would be our fuel source, and what would be the ability to get fuel in here?
I couldn't answer that question.
Has anybody discussed that, ever talked about that? If we had a Japan-style earthquake, and of course, if we had one off of our coast, it'd be massive.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering what the possibility of fuel supply from elsewhere in the United States to help out the coast. Paul, do you know that answer? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I don't know the answer. I just know that I'm going to keep my gas tank.
Chair, Senator Olson, I will say that was one of the topics of discussion at the FEMA conference last year. It was a Cascadia zone earthquake, which would basically, going back to my geology degrees, that would pretty much leave California, would not have a big impact down there. If it's a Cascadia zone, it's going to be off the coast up here, Oregon, Washington. So we would be looking ultimately for fuel supplies coming north and from east, but there are no pipelines that come up that way in either direction. So it would have to be barged up the coast or trucked in over the mountains.
Yeah, and if I might, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, again, it goes to what happened in that earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
Is my service station able to function even if I had fuel?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want that service station functioning? If there's a leak, you don't want it functioning. It's that those kind of issues that we...
Well, that brings me to another question. Mm-hmm. Could you actually service out of your tankers? Could you actually set up a temporary service station out of your tankers? Because they, you know, they wouldn't leak.
Yeah. Senator Olson, Chair, short answer is no. Those are designed to transfer fuel from a large above-ground storage tank to an underground storage tank that's hooked up through a dispenser. We do not have currently equipment to do that, but you'd have to look at some military-type, you know, refueling depot. But the individual oil companies are not in that business. They don't have that capability.
But you could you transfer to a fuel truck, which in turn could, because they have smaller hoses and smaller piping and stuff, would that, is there any possibility to do that?
I would imagine
this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
This is,
I would imagine that there would be, again, assuming that the tanks at terminals are in condition and we can get power to those, to the load racks, and then into the trucks. It's a, the variety of vehicle or trucks can load from those load racks. There are not nozzles and dispensers at the terminals.
Yeah.
Generally, you'd have to get it to a smaller type facility. But again, and I think you're getting to the that. That's getting away from a generator. Again, you wouldn't be looking at the generator to do that. The issue is at the service station. You know, that's the end of the chain, and you don't know which of those stations would be even in condition to operate.
Thank you.
You might be bringing up some of the skills some of us learned as a young people.
Mm-hmm.
Siphoning.
Right. Mm-hmm. the garden hose wonders.
Yes.
Right. I appreciate the difficulty of the position, your discussion, but I mean, and I guess just for the record, I mean, what you're talking about is a ground FARP, and even the military doesn't do that well.
Mm-hmm.
And the military doesn't have much, because they only have what's organic to keep their trucks moving from point A to point B, mm-hmm. which isn't going to help us.
No.
And if you don't know, besides pipelines, there are no military bases over there either.
Right.
I mean, the closest one is Texas. Well, I guess Colorado. We have one in Colorado, come to think of it. It's large. But other than that, there's no cavalry. And if it is, it's the 7th Cavalry, and it didn't do so well.
So, other questions? If not, I appreciate your coming down and giving us a little back brief. And I do want to follow up with both of you on some other ideas that might be feasible. And again, what we're talking about is 50-year ideas, mm-hmm. not ideas for next week.
Yeah. So, Mr. Doherty will be back shortly at some point, and we'll be happy to assist.
You'll be happy
also.
To throw him into the fray. Right?
Yes, I will.
thank you for answering those questions. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to talk about SB 127 or fuel during a based on the Oregon Resilience Plan? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 127, move back to the state police, and ask the state police to come up for a brief presentation. Then we're going to move to the Department of Justice and then down the calendar. And again, just for the record, I think one of you has been here before. Every session, we get to have the state police come in and refresh our memory on their expertise in emergency preparedness and where they sit in their model and their funding and things like that. So we'll indulge us.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I am Joel Lujan with the Oregon State Police. I'm a major with the agency. Been with the agency for 15 years. Prior to that, was a police officer from the state of Texas. What I want to touch on today is really towards the emergency preparedness piece. I've asked Captain Cal Kurtz, who is over the emergency preparedness component of the agency, and we'll invite him to speak after my brief overview. The mission of the state police is to enhance livability, safety by protecting the people, property, and natural resources of the state of Oregon. And how do we accomplish that? We're an integral component of Oregon's public safety system. And part of that, part of the internal systems of the state police that feed into the much larger public safety system of the state of Oregon is that we have a uniform patrol division, criminal division that addresses major crimes and drug enforcement, fish and wildlife division. It's a deployable resource that not only is specific to fish and wildlife crimes, but can also be used as a reinforcing force within the agency. Agency, forensics, the Office of State Fire Marshal, which is also a critical component in emergency preparedness for the state of Oregon, The medical examiner in mass fatality circumstances, they have a program that just in the last year or so through a pass through of funds with UAC grant, we're able to establish the mass fatality program. And then for information services internally and for the public safety system across the state, the criminal justice information system. So in an effort to kind of lay the groundwork of how do we ensure the emergency preparedness, we are we're aggressively pursuing technology through our new implementation of records management system and the computer-aided dispatch. Our previous systems were dated. They were at end of life. So this is going to really reinvigorate, give the officer on the street really the ability to look at live data as it's occurring. Not only that, for the dispatch component, our dispatchers are able to see where our troops are, where they're deployed, what they're doing on real-time basis. Every police car that we're deploying, we're working towards putting mobile data terminals so that this technology is readily available to our troopers. The technology really is really the infrastructure that we've lacked for many years, and this is really going to modernize the agency. And right now we've gone live with our records management system and our CAD system, and we're already really achieving some benefits from that. We're communicating with the courts on our citations electronically, but also stop information and contacts is real time. The key is to go paperless, and again, also to draw information to help us identify problem areas and address them through data, as opposed to the manual systems that we have used in the past. We're aligning our resources with our public safety partners, the sheriffs, chiefs, district attorneys, Department of Justice, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, courts. And again, focusing not only on an active shooter, but on all the other encompassing problems that can come with natural preparedness, or emergency preparedness, rather, with regard to natural disasters or man-made disasters. So the goal is to improve our operations, our data sharing, evidence-based policing, and achieve efficiencies.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Calvin Kurtz. I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police. I've been with the State Police for over 35 years, and currently I'm the captain of the Criminal Division. I'm here today to talk about agency emergency preparedness. And as you can imagine, the OSP regularly operates in a variety of emergency situations. And we have taken steps to support our ability to function in critical environments such as vehicular crashes, storms, natural disasters, or terrorist events. Troopers and supervisors have received FEMA-sponsored emergency management training through various online and classroom trainings, as well as practical exercises. In 2012, OSP updated the Agency Emergency Operations Plan to follow FEMA standards and is consistent with the State Emergency Operations Plan. Each OSP Area Command also has its own local emergency operation plan that coordinates with local partners in support of the overall OSP Emergency Operations Plan. OSP is a council member of the Oregon Emergency Management Emergency Response System, also known as OERS. OSP also provides a liaison position to the Oregon Emergency Coordination Center during times when it is activated, and that person has the authority to assign agency resources. OSP has received federal grants for training as well as emergency response equipment. for such things as our explosive unit, for bomb suits, robot upgrades, total containment vessel, and other equipment and training. And OSP also has, you know, maintains a statewide radio system, and all of our vehicles are capable of operating across the state to assist with local events. This was advantageous several years ago in the winter storm event that was mentioned previously on the northern Oregon coast, when the transportation routes to those areas were temporarily disrupted. At that time, I was the region captain for the Northwest region, and we had obviously transportation and communication issues affected us dramatically. Well, we happened to have troopers there at Camp Rylea near Astoria at that time doing some training. We were able to use those troopers to assume emergency response responsibilities right there in the area where they were at. Having the radio system and whatnot and their capabilities was very helpful for that event. We also have some satellite telephones that we've distributed. We had a few, and then after this winter storm event at the coast a few years, we got more satellite phones so that we had distributed to key locations and positions so that we can provide emergency communications should normal lines of communication become disrupted. Regarding the active shooter scenarios, OSP participates with the FBI National Academy Associates, which is currently offering a workshop on preparedness and response, which in cooperation with DPSST is being presented at the DPSST Academy on April 30th, next month. Presenters are from the Center of Personal Protection and Safety. The training is offered to law enforcement, risk managers, corporate security, and schools. So far, we have over 200 people signed up to attend this training. And I have a copy of that training notice if anyone's interested. Thank you. That's a brief overview of our emergency operations preparedness, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
I just have one quick question.
Yes, sir.
You heard the doom and gloom. Of course, you weren't here for the doom and gloom. This is the doom and gloom committee, just in case you don't know. That's what we get to deal with. It's actually a pretty lively day compared to normal days. Having said that, though, you heard the fuel issues, and we heard in the resilience plan, and I think OSP and some others were involved on the edges of the resilience plan. Where do you get your fuel from? I mean, if there's no fuel to get out of the ground, where do you guys keep a fuel reserve? I mean, where does the fuel for your cars, vehicles, generators come from?
Well, Senator Wilquist, members of the committee, the fuel issue used to many years ago. We had our own fuel pumps, and they were customarily at ODOT locations. We don't have those anymore, so we get our fuel commercially in most instances. Last year and a half ago, when I was involved in facilitate the updating the emergency operations plan for us, and it became very obvious during that planning is that our fuel situation is critical. Each of our local emergency operations plans have a provision in them for where the local troopers will get fuel at should fuel sources be cut off. Having said that, I will tell you that in my review of this and planning for this, it became very clear that after about 7 days, we're going to need fuel from somewhere else.
So it'll look like the German army in the Battle of Bulge, siphon hoses, right?
Fuel will be very difficult to. Okay. It's a very problem.
Questions?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, sir, and thank you for your report. Along the lines of the chair, if these crises were to happen, do you guys get priority for the fuel?
Senator Wilquist, members of the committee, yes, like during this storm event from 7 years ago over at the coast, what happens is there's some of those site locations where there is fuel available, and they serve public safety, first responders, as well as the road department and organizations like that that need to keep county and city services available.
Follow up. I had the opportunity to travel with a state trooper one evening. It was quite enjoyable, quite a knowledgeable experience for me to learn what they do daily. My concern was that this particular trooper took me up onto Mount Hood, and radio was extremely difficult for me to hear.
and he had to do it on the fly, going after people and things like that. Has your communication system gotten any better?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, we're currently in the process of, through the state radio project, of actually implementing new radios to the field in the vehicles and also portable radios, and are currently in the process of narrow banding some of the frequencies. And as we deploy, eventually we will go to a digital model that we will see improvements from, based on the planning that's going into place.
Follow up. So in the emergency, if we were to have an emergency in the next year or so, you would have difficulty with communications?
It's a yes and a no. Because even though radio communications, let's say a tower went out, we still could communicate at the local level and still have access to the local frequencies if we needed to. And if even the local system were to go down, we can still communicate line of sight without a repeater in place.
Follow up. Back to the DPSST program on active shooter. I know my trooper mentioned that his weapon, his automatic weapon, was from the Vietnam era. Have we had an opportunity to bring those up a little closer to the time?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, that's really a good question, and I failed to mention that. We are in the progress right now of procuring new rifles for the sworn membership of the agency. It's still an ongoing process, but we're focused on that, especially with the events of Clackamas County recently. There's a need.
The last concern, because his AR-15 was, the barrel was bent, so I just, no, I'm only kidding.
Senator shoots around the corner, then.
That's right, absolutely. But I would tell you that it was a wonderful experience. You got a great trooper there. My concern was for his safety because of the backup from where his central point was. What a great officer you guys put out there. I commend your training to him because he was really good.
Quite a pleasure. Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, thank you for your kind words.
Sir Cordy, any questions? Thank you, John. Appreciate the briefing. We're going to do one more informational meeting and then move on through our list. I'm going to ask the Department of Justice to come up. And again, I thank the state police for their input. Well, now we're going to get technology. All the things we can't do here.
Yeah. They get all the good stuff.
Just while he's getting ready, my equipment is Vietnam era too, and I carried it all the way to Afghanistan and Iraq and back, and it was fine. Nothing wrong with it.
Excuse me. Afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Darren Tweet. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you for your time. And as a over 20-year prosecutor in Oregon, I just can't resist the technology, so hopefully you'll find this briefing helpful. Make sure that I can run this. The mission of the Criminal Justice Division is very important to this presentation for you to understand what our mission is. We're here to fight crime, number one, and protect the citizens of Oregon, and we do that using a unique combination of resources that no other law enforcement agency in Oregon possesses in one building, and that is incorporated into our mission statement. We use prosecutors, analysts, and law enforcement officers working together on a team to fight crime and protect the citizens of Oregon. The purpose of this briefing is to do four things. First, we're going to describe, I have to describe, in number one, I'm a lawyer, and number two, to make it easier for you to understand where we're driven, I have to describe our statutory mission. Number two, provide a briefing on our division's available anti-organized crime and anti-terror capabilities. You'll see, because of our statutory charge, that we really are committed mainly to the pursuit of organized crime and anti-terror in Oregon. Number four, highlight the difficulty of disrupting or dismantling organized crime groups in Oregon, particularly in the rural areas. And then finally, and I'm going to take care of this point right now, to follow up on the discussion on active shooter. To the best of my knowledge and our agency's knowledge, there isn't, and this is just informational, there isn't a program right now specifically targeted at state agencies for training state agencies in what to do in active shooting situations. Through the Fusion Center, we've begun such a program. We presented our first presentation to Portland Alliance of Business Owners and Maintenance Association within the last couple of weeks. That was very well received. And because of that and the need for kind of statewide agency training, we're going to begin training presentations with my department, see how that goes, and then perhaps make it available outside of our department. As I said, we are unique in Oregon in terms of the resources that we combine in a single agency. Because of that, we can do some things that no other law enforcement agency really can do, and many don't have the resources or the statutory charge to do. Number one, we conduct large-scale anti-organized crime operations better and investigations better than any other agency in Oregon. And as we walk through what our agency brings to the table, I hope that you'll agree with me and see the reasons why that exists. Number two, we are the agency for case deconfliction in the state through our watch center, which is part of our intelligence unit. That's very important to officer safety, and what we'll talk a little bit about that, but basically that means that if a law enforcement agency is conducting some sort of a tactical operation, they let us know about that so that we can make that generally available to other law enforcement officers who may be working in the same area. We don't want to have any accidental shootings, law enforcement to law enforcement, and that's what we're here to do. And then number three, we currently fight terrorism and share criminal intelligence with local, state, and federal law enforcement through the Titan Fusion Center. We have completely lost funding for that. As of today, that program is going to go away unless something happens. And I'll talk a little bit about what the Titan Fusion Center brings to the table and what the loss of the Fusion Center would mean to the state of Oregon. The Department of Justice's Criminal Justice Division has several priorities. Many of them are not statutory priorities. They are priorities of the various attorney generals that have developed the program. The main statutory priority of the Department of Justice is to combat organized crime, and you can see that in the first bullet point. I wanted to let you know the other things that we do. We fight child pornography and child exploitation online through our ICAC. We conduct criminal intelligence. We've talked about that, and we help assist law enforcement and district attorneys throughout the state. I'm not going to go through all these bullet points here. We're required by statute to engage in the fight against organized crime. I frequently get asked, is there organized crime in Oregon? Well, what does that mean? Is the mafia here? No. But what we do have is an ever-present threat from drug trafficking organizations, particularly international drug trafficking organizations. And that's mainly what the Department of Justice's Criminal Justice Division is engaged in operating against right now. But we do see organized crime groups in other areas. Outlaw motorcycle gangs, particularly in some parts of the state, have come and gone throughout the course of the years. And there are some European organized crime groups operating in the state as well. So we're required by statute to do a number of different things. Mainly they break down into investigations and then coordinating the sharing of or anti-organized crime information to law enforcement throughout the state. Organized crime is what you think it is. It's two people trying to make money out of organized crime, or it's two or more people committing any number of listed crimes that are traditionally thought to be organized crime-related activities, whether it's gambling or loan sharking or drugs or extortion. The division, just for your situational awareness, is organized in this way. I'm going to talk not about the green sections today, but about the racketeering and public corruptions unit in red and the criminal intelligence unit. Let's start out with the anti-organized crime operations that we have conducted against drug trafficking organizations in Oregon. Recently, we reorganized the Criminal Justice Division and placed a renewed emphasis on counter-surveillance work that we had been doing in the drug trafficking arena. We formed the Narcotics and Electronics Surveillance Team. And you can see the team's mission is solely to disrupt and dismantle drug trafficking organizations in Oregon. What we've done, we've put special agents and prosecutors and analysts in the same work groups and set them free to conduct any kind of operation that they want to do. Over the last biennium, we worked 95 drug trafficking cases, and these are big racketeering style cases. They're not all, we didn't do 95 RICO single operation RICO cases. What we did is we charged 95 people with racketeering or related drug offenses. That's a significant number because those are drug trafficking groups, and we only prosecute at the department the mid to upper level leadership of those drug trafficking organizations. We leave the local jurisdictions to prosecute the lower level offenses. We work currently throughout the state with local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. It's over the past few months we've received an interest from the FBI, from the DEA, and from the ATF, and we're currently working in operation with the DEA and the ATF. One of the other things that this group particularly brings to the table is not just the personnel, but also specialized equipment and training that no other law enforcement officers in the state really have. What I'm talking about here are particular training related to the use of electronic surveillance, and I'm talking about wiretaps, state wiretaps. Those are exactly what you think they are, what you've seen in the movies and watched on TV and read about in books. The wiretap is the single most effective way to defeat and disrupt any criminal operation. There is no better evidence to use against a defendant in court than the defendant's own words. And so we've really focused on that over the past 5 years, certainly. I'm going to give you a couple of examples, case examples. I think that you'll find them helpful as we move forward to really understand the scope of the problem that we're dealing with. But before I do that, I want to kind of walk through some of the threats to Oregon from drug trafficking. You'll see here, this we're still working on through the Oregon High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program, the stats for the fiscal year 2012. But you'll see here on this chart that in 2011, there were 66 drug trafficking organizations identified in Oregon, 66. Of those, the characteristics of those organizations were that they were, many of them, Mexican or Hispanic, and so what we're talking about is international cartel-type drug trafficking organizations, and then you'll see the rest of the physical and situational characteristics of each of these. 66 drug trafficking organizations in the state of Oregon 2 years ago. As I said, we don't have the stats now, but I don't believe that we have done anything to significantly lower that number.
Sir?
Yes?
Those numbers don't add up, the organizational types and the characteristics. Is that, does
yeah.
that mean that the Hispanics and the Caucasians were working together? Or?
Yeah, so the number that I really focus on here is the drug trafficking, the numbers for this. The characteristics, there are more types of organizational types that are not listed on this chart, I guess I would say. These characteristics, and there are different characteristics as well that aren't taken into account in the organization type. I don't know if that answers your question, but if you need more information, I'd be happy to provide that later.
Sir.
Now, I'm sure that you all know this from the newspaper and from the other briefings you may have had. Oregon is identified by the National Drug Intelligence Center as having a federally defined drug trafficking corridor. That's the one that we all know about that goes up I-5 straight to the border with Mexico and straight to the border with Canada. That's a transit route for and is part of the national pipeline for drug trafficking in the United States. What we at the Department of Justice and other law enforcement agencies have realized is this stretch of I-5, particularly from, say, Eugene to Portland, is pretty well taken care of with law enforcement. In fact, because my division is located in Salem, many of our wiretap operations have really focused in this area just because we are very understaffed and the resources are easier to put into play in this area. That leaves the rest of the state. This stretch here from 90 on Highway 97 from both the southern border to the northern border is a well-known drug trafficking corridor, not defined by the federal government as one, but ask any law enforcement officer in the state of Oregon who does this type of work and they'll tell you that this is a drug trafficking corridor. And then also the 395 and 95 sections on the eastern part of the state. And what I think common sense will tell you is that as we continue to conduct operations aggressively in this area of this northwest corner of the state, drug traffickers, not being dumb, are taking advantage of under-resourced law enforcement areas of the state using the 97 corridor and the 395 and 95 corridors. That's not through any fault of any particular law enforcement agency. It's just a reality of what's happened over the course of time. You can see with this chart that the use, at least the arrests for methamphetamine possession and distribution and heroin are on the rise. Let me give you a specific example of how the, first of all, how difficult it is to completely dismantle a drug trafficking operation, even a relatively small one. And then secondly, by way of that example, explain to you specifically what it is the Department of Justice's Criminal Justice Division does. In 2007, the Department of Justice conducted its very first state-authorized wiretap of a drug trafficking organization. That was significant. It had not been done by the department before, and had been very few district attorneys had ever authorized a wiretap. Most of those had been used for homicides. The department, the Criminal Justice Division, always works in cooperation with local district attorneys and local law enforcement. Again, that's because we are too small to do it all ourselves, and also we don't believe that we should do it all ourselves. And so this operation, we worked in Benton, Lynn, Lane, Douglas, and Marion counties. It was an 18-month investigation, as you can see. This operation against this drug trafficking organization seized 6 pounds of meth and all of the other stats that you can see there. One of the significant factors of this operation was that it resulted in an attempted contract killing of the special agent on the case and two witnesses. The defendant in that case was sentenced to prison for that. We've all heard about things happening in other states against law enforcement and prosecutors and judges. This is 2007, and this was a direct result to anti-drug trafficking operation, a wiretap on a drug trafficking organization. These things still happen today. Well, we thought that we had taken care of that drug trafficking organization. As you could see, we sentenced in the teens, at least, of 21 defendants prosecuted, almost 40 years total in prison. That was a significant hit to that drug trafficking organization. We believed, I'm sure, at the time, that had completely disrupted and dismantled the organization. Unfortunately, that's not true. And what we found and what we will continue to find is that no matter how effective the initial operation is against a organization, they'll reconstitute themselves. It may take a little bit of time. But we found out that this organization was running again in Benton, Lynn, and Marion counties. We conducted a second wiretap operation recently. Same organization. Some of the leaders had leadership was in prison, so of course their lieutenants and their sergeants and corporals just promoted themselves up within the ranks. This organization at that time had moved away from the methamphetamine and was now distributing, in addition to meth, heroin. What's interesting about that case is that we seized 26 pounds of heroin out of that operation, which is about 23,000, almost 24,000 doses of heroin out of one criminal operation. In addition, for the first time with this group, we seized firearms. Now, again, that group had been violent to the point where they were hiring a contract killing against witnesses in the case, but I guess they decided that they also needed to be armed for future. Now, to date, we haven't finished the prosecution in this case. We have achieved almost 600 months of prison state time. Now, out of this operation, one of the virtues of wiretapping, again, I told you that the best evidence to use against a defendant is always their own words. It's also the best intelligence. Things we learn through the use of state wiretaps are very valuable to law enforcement officers throughout the state. In addition to the normal things that you see, money, cash, and so forth, guns, in this case, we uncovered an improvised explosive device. And then also, for the first time in the state of Oregon, and we believe nationally, we identified this is a laundry hamper that was specifically built to transport heroin. You can see that the heroin is wrapped in an airtight seal, and we believe it was poured in a liquid form into a hollowed-out cavity in the hamper itself. It was packaged in a package that you would find if you had bought this hamper off the shelf at Costco or Target or wherever you would buy it. So it looked, to all intents and purposes, like a normal commercial hamper that you could buy anywhere. We only knew about this, by the way, because we'd intercepted conversations relating to this. We had a drug trafficking counter drug dog sniff the package, could not find it. We didn't know that the package was actually where the drugs were located in this particular vehicle that was stopped. Ultimately, we were able to convince the defendant that it was in his best interest to let us know exactly what was going on, and the defendant did. And that's the only reason that we know about this. What's important to me to know about that is that this is a highly sophisticated criminal operation. This was an international cartel-related heroin smuggling organization, and somewhere, either in the United States or in some other place, there is a company that is building these things for the specific purpose of sending heroin to Oregon for sale. Before I move on, are there any questions about drug trafficking?
Let me just ask one question. Is it accurate to characterize, well, say an emergency, because you haven't been here and you have a 9-0 earthquake and everything melts down, you got 66 organizations out there. A large number of these are nothing more than standing armies, armed, well-equipped standing armies.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I take you back to that slide. And I think that it's routine. My colleagues from Oregon State Police, who are still with me, can tell you about the search warrants they've been on, and it's routine to find firearms and improvised explosive devices in drug-related search warrants. And I'm not talking about organized cartel-related drug search warrants. I'm talking about everyday run-of-the-mill drug search warrants, let alone what we're talking about here, where we seized during that operation 26 firearms. And so, yes, I would agree with you that some of these organizations are very well armed and aren't, will use them. So, relating to the Criminal Justice Division's anti-terror operations, all of our anti-terror operations are conducted under the umbrella of intelligence sharing that we have a statutory requirement to perform, and that is because we're required to assist and with the intelligence sharing related to organized crime-related activities. And what we've found over the years, both at the state and local level, is that terrorism is obviously a form of organized crime. We have the Criminal Intelligence Unit, which is composed of several sections. I won't talk to you about all of the sections, but this is what the Criminal Intelligence Unit generally does. Again, information sharing. We send out officer safety bulletins throughout the state, prepare threat assessments. We've done threat assessments for the Pendleton Roundup. We've done threat assessments for the Hillsborough Air Show, and also for the track and field events down at the University of Oregon, for instance. We also share terrorism-related information. We provide analytical case support, and we, again, provide deconfliction services for law enforcement operations. So this is just the volume of work that we do with very few criminal analysts. What I want to draw your attention to is the Fusion Center conducted 7,219 intelligence profiles during that 1-year time period. That's suspect-related research directly to Oregon's local law enforcement. They call in, they ask us to run database checks, and we do it. We did that 7,000 cases. In addition, we processed 367 terrorism-related tips and leads, supported 34 wiretap lines. Many of those were federal wiretap lines that are run through the Department of Justice, and then these are the deconfliction checks that we performed. When I say that we process terrorism-related tips, by the way, what we do, we are an information clearinghouse. We take terrorism-related tips, and we try to connect them up to the right law enforcement agency in Oregon. That's our role. So, what we've seen, unfortunately, at the Department of Justice is if there were a critical event in Oregon, we are out of play. We do not have the resources to really perform in that area at all. We've lost 30 positions since 2009. The result of that has been that really any kind of significant case that is unplanned causes massive disruption, so we very carefully plan things out. And we have contingency plans for unplanned cases. But it really does just cause an incredible disruption to the division, even a case coming in, let alone a Cascadia Zone earthquake or something else. I do want to talk about the second bullet point. We have been working to restore grant funds for our Fusion Center. The Fusion Center grant funds have been cut off. These are grant funds that are provided by through DHS, through FEMA, through the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, and then to us. So we're kind of the way downstream beneficiary. Because of the loss of those funds, the grant funds, there are no state funds for the Fusion Center. We will close the Fusion Center. And all of the things that you saw up here, the bulletins, the processing of tips and leads, the deconfliction checks for local law enforcement, and the intelligence profiles, the direct case support to local law enforcement is going to go away.
What's that dollar amount?
The currently, as constituted, the loss was roughly $300,000, and Senator Boquist, Senator Nelson Olson, I can get you the specific numbers. We do have, the Attorney General has added the request to reconstitute the Fusion Center, and we'll be presenting that, and I know has presented that to a number of the members. We recently just had that confirmed that we had indeed lost the money, the federal money. And so we're going to work with the members of the Assembly to try and figure out a way to support the Fusion Center moving forward. I think that our current request is $1.4 million. The other significant impact of losing those positions, of course, has been that we can't provide necessary analytical support to local law enforcement. That's one of the things that the Criminal Justice Division used to do very well. A detective or even a line officer could call up and say, I need this case worked on by an analyst. I need to have someone who has the time to sit down and figure out all of the associations in my case and report back to me what the associations are. We just can't do that on really important cases, child pornography, homicides, gangs, complex financial crimes. We are out of play. And that really means that local law enforcement is out of play too and at a significant disadvantage when trying to fight organized criminal activity. Finally, due to budgetary constraints, we are limited in the number of cases that we can investigate or prosecute in any given calendar year. Our operations, particularly our wiretap operations, are not funded by the general fund. They're funded by ourselves. And so so what that really means is that I can do one or two of these wiretap operations a year. Currently, I have 7 wiretaps in line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, from 5 different agencies or task forces. There are 2 federal agencies and several local task forces that want to work with us, but I have to say, get in line, and when we get to you, we will. And we can only do 1 or 2 large financial crimes cases per calendar year at any given time. Part of the request that you'll see flying around is to add capabilities to the division in this particularly important area of combating drug trafficking organizations. Any questions?
Senator Olson?
Yes, sir. You had some seizures up there in the money. Where does that money go?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, it can go in a variety of different ways. What we try to do, again, because we're self-funded on our organized crime operations, is we try to set up memorandums of understanding with the agencies we're participating in that our expenses will be sent back to the Department of Justice so that we can continue our operations. We've been rolling the same $100,000, roughly, for several years now to conduct our wiretap operations. A wiretap runs in the neighborhood of $100,000 to $200,000, depending on who you're teamed up with and what they can bring into play. After that, then it just goes through the normal kind of either asset forfeiture proceedings or any other intergovernmental agreements that may be in place.
So you don't get to keep which fund?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, we do not. And it wouldn't, you know, it just wouldn't be fair. Other agencies put a lot at stake when they work with us, and what they put at stake is their overtime. And overtime costs for these operations can be very significant.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Courtney has done. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Your presentation. With that, we're going to move on to a public hearing of SB 808. Council, if you would, please.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, excuse me, Senate Bill 808 exempts from taxation the greater of $18,000 or 50% of the assessed value of home or personal property of veterans with service-connected disability of 100%, and in some cases, veterans' unmarried surviving spouse under certain conditions.
And Mr. Schmidt, if you want to come forward at the same time. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Clock's ticking.
Pardon?
Clock's ticking.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator from representing Senate District 20. Currently, we've had over 30,699 Oregonians deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. Many of those soldiers have come back because they have better body armor, but they've come back injured, and many have come back 100% disabled. We currently have 331,000 approximately veterans that live in our state, and using some mathematics, we have determined that there's probably in the vicinity of 7,000 100% disabled veterans in our state. Of that 7,000 veterans in our state, potentially 4,500 own homes. The problem is, and a good, very knowledgeable gentleman asked me a couple weeks ago, if we were to give these veterans a lifetime benefit for their home, I didn't have an answer at the time, but the answer now is that they have a lifetime of disability. They will forever be 100% disabled. And when you look at the opportunity they get from the federal government and the amount of money that they receive for their living expenses, when you look at the property taxes taken out of that, it doesn't leave much left. And a constituent of mine got a hold of me this summer and said, you know, my husband's 100% disabled. Our property taxes are really causing us a problem. Would there be a way to fix this? So I took a look at it and found that active duty members get a $60,000 deduction, or exemption, I should say, from their property taxes. And so we went along those lines. And I will say that we do have an amendment for this bill to change it to a $60,000 exemption. And that amendment, I think, was handed off to you today, Cheyenne, so it might be a little late to talk about it. But we amended the bill to a $60,000 exemption for members that are 100% disabled. This is a good bill, and it's a good bill because it supports those people that supported us and gave their all, other than short of their life. Forever, they will be 100% disabled. This allows them to remain in their homes and have a standard of living that they wouldn't have without this.
Thank you. Mr. Schmidt.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and really the only reason that I signed up to testify today was the original writing of the bill would have been very difficult for the assessors to administer and implement. It would have been cost in rewriting, but if the amendment calls for just a standard dollar amount exemption, then the assessors have no problem with that. In fact, I think it's a well-deserved benefit for those veterans. As a veteran myself, I think they deserve it. One question, and it was asked, will the wording be to index that exemption like the other exemptions for 40% disabled, so that it will go up, I think, the 3% each year?
I believe it is.
Okay.
And when the original amendment came down, they had actually changed assessment because of the indexing. It had bumped it to 76,000. Do you have that amendment, Cheyenne?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, no, not yet.
Okay, I'm sorry. But we will get that to you, Chair, and Cheyenne, we will have that for you. But we will index it, and we will start at the 60,000 amount. But this is a good bill. This is good support for our veterans that have survived the trauma that they live with.
And Mr. Schmidt, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Senator Courtney?
I have no questions.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 808 and open. Excuse me?
2 minutes.
Who's coming? Let's go. Oh, great. So we're not going to open. And we're not going to wait 2 minutes either.
Recess.
No, we're not. We're going to move on.
I'll come back.
SB 820 has a technical two-minute delay, so we can't use it technically. So we're going to move into work session and come back to that. I apologize, but we're doing a couple work sessions that we have to clean up some work. So with that, we are going to open a work session on SB 34. Council, if you'll advise us the status for SB 34.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senate Bill 34, as well as Senate Bill 35, were previously heard on 228. This is the one that removes the limit on the number of home or farm loans received or assumed from the Department of Veterans Affairs, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment that limits eligible persons to four loans instead of an unlimited number, and this is because both these measures went to a work group on March 18th. Representatives from ODVA were there, as well as Treasury. It was led by Senator Olson, and this is sort of where they arrived. There is no revenue impact on the Dash 1 amendment, no fiscal impact on the Dash 1. And we've also received supplemental information from ODVA, which is posted to OLIS, that recapped the circumstances that differentiate current measures and current financial situation from the 1980s, which was a concern to the committee at the previous meeting.
And so for clarity's sake in the public, what we have to do is, if we want to move forward, is adopt the Dash 1 amendment and then adopt the bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Senator Cornyn.
I move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/19/13.
President Cornyn moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/19/13. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
I move Senate Bill 34 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
President Cornyn moves SB 34 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Senator Olson? Senator Cornyn, any opposition? See no opposition, so ordered. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing, except that we're going to sign a carrier and volunteers are accepted, Senator Olson. With that, the work session on SB 34 is closed. I'm going to open a work session on SB 35. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the second measure that went to work group, Senate Bill 35, along with Senate Bill 34, although Senate Bill 35 was just trailing and no alterations were made to it. It was previously heard on February 28th. It modifies the limit on the dollar amount of home and farm loans made by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to permit ODVA to take advantage of the federal loan program and to offer those loans. There was no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal, so no statement issued.
And so this one would just go straight to the floor. Senator Olson.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 35 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves SB 35 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion, Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Cornyn?
No.
Any opposition? So ordered. With that, the work session on SB 35 is closed, and since we just have one more on the front sheet, he's carrying. With that, I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on SB 133. If you would please, Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 133 was previously heard on February the 14th, February the 21st, and March the 7th. It has a dash one amendment that was already adopted. That was on March the 7th. It has a revenue statement. It's a revenue light on the Dash 1. Also a minimal fiscal, so no statement issued on the Dash 1. This has a subsequent referral to joint tax credits. This measure creates personal and corporate income tax credit for an employment of veterans if certain conditions are met. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2013 and before January 1st, 2019 and takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment signee die. The Dash 1 amendment was worked out with Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Revenue who came to testify. It requires qualifying veterans to work in Oregon. It cleans up language concerning the amount of the credit that's available depending on the number of hours worked and requires the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to notify eligible taxpayers. And it removes a record-keeping requirement so that existing law as to records will govern.
And for the record, I did advise the committee members that if we do pass this, I have sent out to all committee members the draft list recommendations, which we're required to fill out, for the Committee on Tax Credits, which I do serve on. So this one will be simply moving from our chamber on, or our committee on, to the Committee on Tax Credits. Senator Cornyn?
Move Senate Bill 133 is amended to the Tax Committee, right?
Right.
To the Tax Committee with a do-pass recommendation that bill be referred. Well, all right. To the floor. That's not correct. I do not want to move to the floor. Strike that. I move Senate Bill 133 with a do-pass recommendation to the Committee on Tax Credit by prior reference.
President Cornyn moves SB 133 to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference with a due passage. Discussion? Seeing none, so is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. With that, we're going to close the work session on SB 133, and we've now moved beyond the posting limit for the public hearing on SB 820. Senator Olson, if you'd be kind enough to move down there. So therefore, we're going to open a public hearing on SB 820. And for the record, so everybody knew what we were doing, because you thought we didn't, is this bill came to the committee late in the process, and we were required to have a certain amount of time for posting, and so therefore we couldn't actually hear the bill until precisely 14:24 or later, which is 2:24 p.m. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 820, thank you, requires public universities and community colleges to charge in-state tuition for all honorably discharged veterans, regardless of residency. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
If you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Alan Olson. For the record, I am a senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. I have issued or written Senate Bill 820 in the effort to allow our veterans who have served honorably and for our nation to have in-state tuition in our state. Several other states have this facility already, and here's some of the things that they said. This bill will attract veterans to our state and in the process improve our workforce and economy. Tennessee employers need workers that have strong technical skills and aptitude. Veterans are such a group. In California, California attempted this bill and was not successful. But wonderful representative down there said, our veterans and military members deserve the right to go to any university they would like, regardless of what state they originally came from, because they have fought for our entire country, not just an individual state. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is very similar to the bill that was over on the House side. The main difference is, as I have put on there, that you must have been discharged under honorable conditions. If you will, these soldiers, these people that have served our nation, whether it be from the Vietnam era or all the way up to now to our current wars, these men have given up time and energy and effort from their lives to protect our nation. And I think we as a state should provide them with the opportunity to come here and enjoy our livability, our beautiful mountains, and our wonderful universities. Yes, it will be a little bit of a fiscal issue for our universities. However, colleagues, on this bill, we have 54 legislators that agree with me that this is a good opportunity to support and honor our veterans. These folks are well-motivated, intelligent people. I have distributed to you a picture of a gentleman that basically took a bullet off the helmet. These are the kind of gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen that fight in the military and fight for our rights and honors to be here and sit and talk about this. These are the kind of people that we want in our state. They would be a great asset to our state as they came here to get educated from our universities. They would be a great asset because they will remain, create jobs and businesses, and I think this is a good bill to honor veterans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. And just for the record, there are several House members that express interest in submitting written testimony, but due to the posting and the quickness here, that hasn't come in yet. Members of the public that would like to submit testimony can do so between now and next week. And if there is someone that comes in the next week that wants to testify, we will post this for another public hearing next week to ensure that there is additional public input.
Mr. Chair, if I may also add, with your indulgence, the federal government has an act called the GI Bill Tuition Fairness Act of 2013, and it's in the process of going through the federal government to allow GIs from anywhere to go to any state for in-state tuition. I would like Oregon to be on the forefront of that and show that we honor our veterans. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Senator Cordy? Thank you very much. And with no one else signed up, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 820. And we're going to process a couple of bills before we go out. And then we have one individual that wants to bring us up to date on another bill. With that, I'm going to open a work session on SB 97. Madam Counsel, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe you 597.
597.
And we've just received a fiscal impact that issued during the meeting. And I want to to make sure the members had that. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 597 was previously heard on March 21st. This measure reiterates that funds held in the emergency communications account must be used for purposes described in ORS 403-240. It requires a statutory change to deviate from the purposes described in ORS 403-240. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. This has a no revenue impact, and as I just indicated, a fiscal statement just issued, which LFO recommends that it is warranted for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which was previously discussed but not on the record, I believe, and the President's office had notice, and a motion was prepared to that effect if the committee is so inclined.
So thank you, Council. So we'll be sending this to Ways and Means. Senator Olson.
Do you want me to say yes, or do you want me to comment?
You have to make a motion first.
I have to make a motion.
Then you can speak.
No, this is 35. Where's it's under here.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 597 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. I guess that would be wrong. And that the bill, there we go. And that the bill will be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Olson moves SB 597 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion, Senator Olson?
Yes, there is. This is a bill that is way beyond its time. We had testimony at our last get-together talking about the necessity of upgrading our technologies. The money that has been previously swept from this bill or from this account could have paid for the first 2 years of those technologies. Technology changes quickly. This money is designed for a specific reason, and I feel there's enough safeguards in there that if we absolutely positively have to have it, we can get to it. But if we don't have to have it, it needs to stay in there so that we can develop our 911 systems to a further level than they are now. And as we look at these monies and say, well, that's pretty nice to have that, it really is. But with technological changes, we need to be able to save lives with what we can purchase, and we can't purchase it if the money's not there.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Further discussion? Opposition? There's no opposition, so ordered. With that, I'm going to close the work session on SB 597. I'm going to open a work session on SB 813.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 813 was previously heard on March 21st. It's the measure that moves the seismic rehab program, the grant program, from the Office of Emergency Management to the Department of Administrative Services. There was a Dash 1 amendment that was discussed that replaces DAS with the Oregon Business Development Department Infrastructure Finance Authority, and it adds a representative of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators to the grant committee. There is no revenue impact on the Dash 1, and a fiscal statement issued, which is on the dais for everyone, as well as posted on OLIS for the Dash 1 amendment. It has a subsequent referral as well to Ways and Means by prior reference.
And for the public, then what we need to do is we'll have to adopt the Dash 1 amendment, which is a consensus amendment, and some technical changes, and then adopt the main bill, and from there it'll be sent to Ways and Means by prior reference. Senator Courtney.
I move, Mr. Chair, to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 19, 2013 to Senate Bill 813.
President Courtney moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated the 19th of March 2013. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any opposition? So ordered.
Move Senate Bill 813 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
President Courtney moves SB 813 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion, Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Courtney? Opposition? So ordered. With that, the work session on SB 813 is closed. The work session on House Bill 2442 is open, and I believe we're going to invite Mr. Neck up at the same time, who'd like to make some comments while you tee it up, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill
2422,
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was previously heard on March 21st. This is the measure that requires the Department of Human Services to communicate a veteran's name and address to the Department of Veterans Affairs monthly if it's authorized by the veteran when the veteran makes a written request about certain assistance programs. It also authorizes DHS to make rules to achieve that end. There's no revenue impact. A fiscal statement issued, but it is indeterminate, and there is no subsequent referral passed out of the House floor and committee unanimously.
Thank you, counsel. And at the chair's discretion, Mr. Neck, you said you wanted to make a few brief comments?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, Sherry, and Senator Peter Courtney, I want to thank you for all your hard work that you do for the veterans, and you can't do it alone. As you know, I do a lot of advocacy work for veterans in this community and for people with disabilities, and I work with our incarcerated veterans. And I am in support of Senate Bill 1, and I am in support of Senate Bill 2422. And Mr. Senator Olson, the comment you were just up here about the money for the veterans, I support that bill also, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And I was in the Army myself, and Senator Boquist, when I have a matter, I come up here and see him. He took care of a matter here the other day. Again, he has sent out memos to the police departments and to the Sheriff's Association, because when the veterans has a crisis, they call the police department, and one friend got himself in a little bit of trouble, but it sounds like they're going to drop that charge. And so I come up here and talk to Mr. Senator Boquist, because he's been there, and they could have just as well have told him where to call. But anyway, that's beside the point. And like he said, he can't do it alone. And I thank you for your comments that you have given me. And Peter Courtney, I've known you a good many years too, and all the comments you've given me. And so I just wanted to do that. So thank you very much. And I have a written, if you want this. It's not my best handwriting. And I've known this lady here a long time too. So thank you very much for your time and consideration today, folks.
And thank you for your service. Senator Olson.
Chair Boquist, I move House Bill 2442 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2442 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Opposition? Seeing none. So ordered. Senator Olson has volunteered to carry it and close the work session on House Bill 2442, open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution 4.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll recall this was heard on March 21st, honoring Lieutenant Commander Neil Swarthout for heroic acts as a United States Navy pilot during World War II and the Korean War. There's no revenue and no fiscal and no subsequent referral, and Senator Roblin is an additional sponsor on this measure on the Senate side.
So if we do pass this, and we'll probably ask Senator Roblin or myself to carry it.
Or yourself.
One of the two. Senator Courtney.
I move HCR 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. I'm just reading my script, so it's a little different. I don't know, as opposed to do pass, so I assume that's significant.
It is significant, but it is correct, Senator. And having said that, President Courtney moves House Concurrent Resolution 4 to the House Concurrent Resolution 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Discussion, Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Courtney? Opposition? Okay. Seeing none, so ordered. The work session on H, and either Senator Roblin or myself will carry this. With that, the work session on HCR 4 is closed, and I'm going to open a work session on HCR 11.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 11 was also previously heard a week ago on March 21st. It honors Brigadier General Julie Bentz for being the first female Brigadier General of the Oregon Army National Guard. No revenue impact, no fiscal, no subsequent referral.
And I believe Representative Bentz has asked that I carry this if it's adopted, right?
That's correct.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Boquist, I move HCR 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Olson moves HCR 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there further discussion? Senator Courtney?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Olson, opposition?
Yep.
Seeing no opposition, so ordered. I will be the carrier. I'm going to close the work session on HCR 11, open the last work session of the day on HJM 1. Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, HJM 1 urges Congress to overturn the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs regulation prohibiting provision of service or therapy dogs for veterans with emotional and mental disabilities. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral on this measure.
Thank you. Senator Courtney.
I move HJM 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
President Courtney moves HDM 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Courtney, Senator Olson,
no.
Any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Is there another? And Senator Courtney has volunteered one of the two to carry this on the floor. We do appreciate that, good Senator. With that, I'm going to close the work session on HJM1. Further business, Senator Courtney?
I do not have any.
Senator Olson?
None.
With that, the meeting for the day for Senate Committee Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is concluded.